Good morning. I welcome you to the opening round of Sunstone Sessions this morning. And this is the number one on that round, so it's a very distinctive spot. Charlotte and I were talking up here, and we expect... What? Can you hear it now?
He's too tall. Got a bandit microphone.
I'm sorry, can you hear it now?
Just bend to the microphone, and then I can hear you.
Am I speaking to the microphone? Learn from this.
Okay. Okay,
we were fortunate to have Charlotte Hanson going to address some issues about her grandfather, Eugene England, and she dedicated part of her master's thesis for that, and she's going to share her insights on that to Charlotte. Parents are here, Jody and Mike Hanson. I had the privilege of being privy to a lot of the letters she wrote as a missionary for a year and a half in Cleveland or Kirtland, Ohio Mission, whatever it is. She was in Kirtland, probably. Anyway. And she was, I think, probably the prototype of what a mission president would love in a missionary. She was enthusiastic, devoted, committed, loved every minute of it, and I think it's going to reflect itself in the information we get from her that she's dug up about her grandpa. Anyway, she'll go on from there, and then when she finishes, I'll entertain questions or comments that you might have.
Okay, I'll make sure to speak right into the mic so you guys can hear me. Is that good? Okay, just checking. Just making sure. So, just like Toby was saying, I'm the granddaughter of Charlotte and Eugene England. And that's one of the reasons I actually studied Eugene England's writings for my thesis. And another connection is that I actually helped organize his papers that are in the Marriott Library and being processed right now. So it was a really interesting connection of how that worked. So as I'm going through, a lot of this came from mostly his writings and then also some things I found in his papers. So definitely look for those in the next, hopefully in a year, 6 months maybe, so that you can go and actually look at those personally in the Marriott Library here at the University of Utah. Eugene England, who was a graduate of the University of Utah and whose papers are currently being processed at the Marriott Library, was an influential English and Mormon literature professor. He was also a pioneer in the fields of Mormon literature and studies, who asked the hard questions in his writings and helped to build faith through that process. Through the process of studying Eugene England's papers for writing and writings for my honors thesis at the University of Utah, I was able to see the development of his own personal voice, as well as track his thinking on his academic interests. I found in his writings a deep commitment to respectful dialogue, academic freedom, and a determination to remain within the institution of the LDS Church. England wanted to create spaces where those who felt distanced from the LDS Church could feel accepted and loved, spaces where it was safe to question, and through the questioning, find truth and come closer to God. Krista Tippett, host of the NPR show Speaking of Faith, said in a recent Sterling M. McMurrin lecture at the University of Utah campus that religion needs a place in the public university. Religion in the latter part of the 20th century was done in private. People could not imagine intelligent public religious discussion without proselytizing occurring. Now, in the 21st century, we are seeing changes. Academia is beginning to recognize religion and spirituality as essential to any discipline. There is less compartmentalization occurring in fields, and religious studies programs are getting established and expanding on American campuses. Krista Tippett and others are calling for and seeing realized today what England started to speak about in the 1960s, open dialogue between the secular and the spiritual. By analyzing England's writings, we can find ways to create a better dialogue now in the early 21st century, especially on university campuses. The University of Utah has just begun its own religious studies program in the past year. For this program to succeed and to create a healthy dialogue concerning Mormon studies, there needs to be a shift from polarizing attitudes and a desire for academic freedom that makes space possible for dialogue that builds community. In 2009, I took a British studies seminar from Professor Mark Matheson, where we discussed as a class John Milton and the prophetic voice. We defined a prophet as someone from the outskirts desiring to change society or religion from within and take the people forward. Matheson said one thing that resonated with me in that class. Milton realized that through a process of questioning and going into doubt, you could emerge in some sense healed. He realized that it was not only from the pulpit that the word of God could be spoken. It could come from a poet like himself. At that moment, I finally understood what England had chosen to do with his life's work, even if he hadn't recognized it exactly in this way. Develop and serve as a prophetic voice. Let me explain what I mean by prophetic voice. In an essay about prophets in America around 1830, Richard H. Broadhead defines the prophetic voice in this way, and it's a longer quote, so. A prophet is a person singled out to enjoy special knowledge of ultimate reality and to give others mediated access to that otherwise unavailable truth. A prophet is also a man with a mission, one whose relation to a deep truth both requires and entitles him to enact that knowledge against the grain of worldly understandings. To say this is not to declare that some figures actually are this rare, super-entitled kind of self. Though religious belief will confer the status of true prophet on some figures and deny it to others, the decision that a Jesus or a Muhammad or a Joseph Smith was God's earthly messenger lies at the core of the choice of faith. The history of prophetism must include everyone who has envisioned and asserted himself on these terms. Apart from the designation of faith, the prophet is never just something a person is, but also something a person takes himself to be and demands to be taken as. This means that in the prehistory of any act of prophetic identification, a person must have access to some concept of the prophet, an image that circulates in the cultural repertoire of identities as one idea of what a self can be. When people become prophets, they identify with some concept of the prophetic self, project themselves into this concept, and use it to tell themselves and others who they are. End quote. The prophetic voice does not always come from one true prophet, is what we learn from this quote. Many people consider themselves to be prophets in the way that Broadhead explains, in a different way than Joseph Smith or Muhammad. The Old Testament is filled with the words of many different prophets, such as Isaiah having coal placed on his tongue for purification to speak the words of God. In history, many writers, such as Milton and Emerson, spoke of feeling a calling to profess truth in their writings and call people to action, and in a way, this can be seen as prophetic. Broadhead focuses on Joseph Smith, Nat Turner, and Ralph Waldo Emerson as examples of prophetic voices in the 19th century. Martin Luther King Jr. served as a prophetic voice in the 20th century. At great personal cost, he challenged the norms that society had created, boldly calling for correction of values, beliefs, changed hearts, and minds. Einstein spoke for the rights of African Americans as well, but he also spoke out against science being used to harm humankind rather than help. He believed that there was a moral stature of science itself, and said that all should have a positive responsibility for their own actions. Rachel Carson advanced the environmental movement with her writings on the ocean and synthetic pesticides, which led to the organization of the Environmental Protection Agency. Gandhi, called the father of the nation in India, participated in and promoted the use of civil disobedience, and also advocated for people to speak the truth. These amazing individuals indicate that prophetic voices can be found in many different disciplines and nations. Broadhead compares Joseph Smith and Emerson in their different views of prophetic identity. Within both Smith's and Emerson's concepts of the prophetic, there are elements of Eugene England. In 1838, Emerson addressed the Harvard Divinity School and spoke of the role of a preacher prophet, is what he called. Emerson proclaims that the function of the great prophets of the past is to call us to our own prophetic careers. For Emerson, God is revealed in any strong display of self. Broadhead observes the effects of this concept, and I quote, Emerson's work is to revive a prophetic conception of selfhood and rethink it in such a way that prophetic identity becomes virtually synonymous with selfhood itself. Personal identity is elevated in this process, made identical with the elect selfhood previously reserved for the prophets. Prophecy itself is also radically diffused through this reconceptualization, removed from the category of rarity and made widely available and familiar. The selfhood that is in touch with the sacred is reimagined by Emerson as something completely democratic, something open to each of us to the extent that we have an identity and are someone. End quote. According to Emerson, the prophetic is within anyone who can identify and express their essential self. Part of our essential selves is our religious identity, and England saw himself as essentially Mormon. In the Emersonian sense, England developed the prophetic voice in his writings, especially his writings challenging and critiquing the academic institution and religious culture. England championed the personal essay, a literary form where there's discovery of the true self through revealing it to the world. Prophetic voice is what makes the personal essay work. God is found through personal evaluation, and revelation and a call to action can emerge through such a process. Both Emerson and Smith claim that revelation is not dead, and that direct access to divinity is possible. Unlike Emerson, Smith asserts absolute truths and also claims to be God's elect intermediary. Professing to possess authority direct from God, he founded a new institution of religion with a unique theology. In contrast, Emerson, having founded his career on the refusal of received rights, the last thing he has in mind is the creation of new ones. It is because of the institution of religion that Emerson left the churches and spoke of the discovery of God within. By accepting the religious institution's authority to divine truth, England follows the route of Joseph Smith. He believes in the importance of belonging and remaining committed to a religious community. Yet one must also realize the prophetic voice within, which is different from the prophetic leader. England's prophetic voice encourages community without the extremes of blind obedience or disloyal dissent. By identifying with and being loyal to his religious community, England is similar to Old Testament prophets and other religious writers, such as Isaiah and Milton. He is part of the institution and has a strong faith within it, but he feels that calling from God to improve the institution. He points out hypocrisy and failures, first within himself, and calls everyone to repentance and rededication to core beliefs. Just as in other writers, this powerful personal voice that develops can be traced back to England's early writings. There are many different issues that England emphasized in his writings and lectures, but there is one topic that England writes on more than any other, which was a central theme of his life, the importance of dialogue. One of England's favorite quotes from Joseph Smith is, "By proving contraries, truth is made manifest." He believes that in exploring opposing ideas and questioning assumptions, we come closer to God and find our true selves. Just as Milton saw that in being a poet, he could ask the questions that could heal the souls of those who read his works, England believed that in writing and promoting dialogue, the same result could be reached. Dialogue will keep people within the institution. Academic freedom, or the right for a teacher to teach and a student to learn, was closely connected with England's concept of dialogue. As a professor, he saw that a university was one of the best places to ask questions and find truth. England's deep commitment to dialogue led him to create spaces for those who identified with, yet felt distance from, the institution, to have a community to address their struggles, just as a classroom can be a space for constructive dialogue to occur. England had a strong case to make for the importance of dialogue, but it was also a difficult one to make to the institution of secular and religious universities alike. Many people are uncomfortable with open dialogue, whether in a religious or secular context. But despite this opposition, England was strong in his convictions, and learned from his experiences of failure and success in creating constructive dialogue. Greatly influenced by prominent scholars teaching at that time, including Lowell Bennion, Sterling McMurrin, and Jack Adamson, England's voice began to develop when he was at the University of Utah during the 1950s. England had a profound paradigm shift in 1964 when he was a Danforth Fellow at Stanford University, working on a doctorate in English, focusing on American literature. At this point, England professes relatively liberal views that he found more aligned with the core doctrines of the Latter-day Saint faith. Employed as an LDS Institute instructor, he was warned not to teach ethics of violence if he wanted to keep his job. He was also serving in the Stanford bishopric. As he navigated the secular and religious worlds, England struggled with exactly where he fit, and I quote, "As I served in these capacities, I saw more and more how relative are the terms liberal and conservative. I found I could change from one to the other simply by walking across Stanford Avenue from the university to the institute building. On campus, among graduate students and anti-war civil rights activists, I was that strange, non-smoking, short-haired, family-raising conservative. At the institute, I was that strange liberal who renounced war and worried about fair housing and free speech. Of course, I was the same person both places. Those terms reduced me to a stereotype, often marginalized me, and sometimes caused me real harm. but they did not touch my real self." End quote. In both the secular and religious institutions that England was involved in, he did not fit the stereotypes that people had given him. He consciously rejects being reduced to these stereotypes. As he says, they did not touch his real self. But what was England's true self that was not being touched? Through later writings, it is evident that his real self is the authentic self, a self that recognizes its own shortcomings, cannot be contained in any one label, and does not allow others to be comfortable in their labels either. This reflection indicates to me how England at this time begins developing a personal voice unrestricted by the institution. By 1965, it is evident which path England decides to tread. Rather than trying to fit into either stereotype, he begins to create his own path, along with others. Recognizing a need for a space where Mormon intellectuals can publish and struggle with their questions, he co-founds Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, with several other graduate students. Even though this would generally be seen as a liberal thing to do, England saw himself as still basically conservative. He says that he helped to start Dialogue, quote, "for the express purpose of helping young LDS students, like those he taught each day at Stanford, build and preserve their testimonies," end quote. In England's first editorial called The Possibility of Dialogue, his prophetic voice begins to emerge. England talks about the risk, but also the importance of faithful questioning. He states, "The very principles I accept as definitive of my life warn me to be continually open to the revelation of new possibilities for my life from both God and man." England finds revealed truth in all around him and is open to that direction. England believes, quote, "Dialogue is possible if we can avoid looking upon doubt as a sin or as a virtue, but can see it as a condition that can be productive if it leads one to seek and knock and ask, and if the doubter is approached with sympathetic listening and thoughtful response," end quote. Dialogue is a condition or context, an environment that can be created. Within this condition of dialogue, England says we must express ourselves in a certain way. Quote, "A dialogue is possible if in trying to describe our findings and convictions, we can be honest with ourselves and each other," end quote. Dialogue cannot reach its full possibilities unless there is charity, since dialogue is about engaging others in genuine conversation. And I quote again, "We must truly listen to each other, respecting our essential brotherhood and the courage of those who try to speak, however they may differ from us in professional standing, or religious belief, or moral vision. We must speak and listen patiently, with good humor, with real expectation, and our dialogue can serve both truth and charity," end quote. This idea of dialogue is what motivated England to encourage academic freedom. Only by having opposing opinions can truth be found and society survive. England concludes the essay, "My faith as a Mormon encourages, by specific doctrine, my feeling that each man is eternally unique and godlike in potential, that each man deserves a hearing, and that we have something important to learn from each man if we can hear him, if he can speak and we can listen well. Dialogue is possible for those who can. Such a dialogue will not solve all of our intellectual and spiritual problems, and it will not save us, but it can bring us joy and new vision and help us toward that dialogue with our deepest selves and with our God, which can save us." England sees each person and their words as important. He encourages dialogue because it helps each person to have open dialogue with God. As England says earlier, dialogue cannot reach its full potential without charity. Only by having charity can God's words be heard. England's desire is to bring people closer to Christ and help them hold fast to good things. He challenges his readers to make the choice to listen with love and allow others to speak. Soon after the start of Dialogue the Journal, England was invited to speak at the LDS Institute students at the University of Utah. In that lecture, he states, "The burden of effort lies with the critic, that those who think they see something wrong with an institution, such as the church, are the ones who bear the burden of doing something about it, something effective, something that takes cognizance of their responsibility to other people and how they can respond to them, that they have no right to withdraw and throw rocks." President Hugh B. Brown, one of England's mentors and an unwavering dialogue supporter, says the following in an address to BYU students in 1969, quote, "One cannot think right without running the risk of thinking wrong, But generally, more thinking is an antidote for the evils that spring from wrong thinking. And we call upon you, students, to exercise your God-given right to think through on every proposition that is submitted to you, and be unafraid to express your opinions with proper respect for those to whom you talk and proper acknowledgement of your own shortcomings. We are not so much concerned with whether your thoughts are orthodox or heterodox as we are that you shall have thoughts." End quote. England was a disciple who thought, just as Brown urged BYU students to do in this address. Like other prophetic voices, England did not have to fit in either category of critic or apologist, as many people had expected he would. England's uniquely Mormon voice and his method of faithful questioning make his words still relevant to discussions on campuses today. England also wanted to help students understand what being a Mormon intellectual meant. In an address to BYU students in 1974, he states, quote, "I use the term intellectual in an essentially neutral way, as descriptive of your gift from God that makes you delight in ideas, alive to the life that goes on in your mind, as well as outside it. That makes you question and set forms and conventional wisdom to see if they really are truth or only habit. I use the term intellectual to refer to the gift from the Lord that makes you curious about why as well as how, anxious to serve him by being creative as well as obedient. To England, being an intellectual is a gift from God, and the term should not be viewed in such a negative light. England's journey at BYU and UVSC in the final 25 years of his life is one in which England's hope for more academic freedom is both realized and restricted. Just as they had at Stanford and St. Olaf, England's writings give a glimpse into these transitions that occurred. Despite the setbacks that England experiences at BYU, he is still able to see the calculated risk of academic freedom be realized later at UVSC, leading to his final lecture at the Sunstone Symposium, where he continues to advocate for the rights of students and teachers. In 1977, when England started teaching at BYU, he saw the university as having the type of academic freedom that he saw as most important, since students and teachers could talk positively about their beliefs. He felt a deep shock of recognition at BYU, saying that it was home. During the 1980s, issues with academic freedom arose at BYU, and he spoke out, challenging the administration and calling the faculty and students to action. One of a few professors willing to make a public stand, England continued to publish editorials and give lectures advocating for academic freedom. In 1990, in an article in the Student Review, an independent student newspaper at BYU, England says that there must be opposition in all things, even at BYU. He provides a model that BYU should follow. Quote, "The proper model for opposition in all things is an open marketplace of ideas, where we seek out those who disagree with us as best helps us in improving our research and thinking, where we constantly create opportunities for public clash of ideas through debates, open forums, independent publications, and seminars." End quote. Dialogue is essential to the true academic freedom that England envisions. These two passions of England begin to coincide in a very powerful way in many of his essays. In 1992, England writes an article about spectral evidence. He talks about the Salem witch trials, where the idea of spectral evidence comes from, meaning evidence that is based on the idea that people have devils doing their bidding. He says that Mormons do many of the same things that have occurred throughout history with spectral evidence. Quote, "We too make judgments of other human beings based on static, partial, even merely recorded images of them that we take to represent their whole beings, and therefore to constitute the basis for a fair presumption of their evilness or guilt, which we and others must act on. When we do so, we use evidence that is as spectral and devilishly dangerous as that which condemned the Puritan witches." End quote. England says that when BYU students complain about a teacher to their church leaders rather than speaking to with their professors, or when people are rejected from a teaching position or from publication because of their unusual beliefs or controversial reputation, that is spectral evidence. He continues, quote, "Human beings cannot be reduced to an action, a political or intellectual position, a quotation in a newspaper, an essay or story they have written. Each of those, even if clearly and fully seen, which is impossible since we always see only partially from a particular point of view, is still only a part, a static part of what is a constantly dynamic, complex, failing, and repenting potential God. We are never less, and actually much more because of our infinite potential, than the complete sum of our history, our stories, a sum which is constantly increasing, changing through time." End quote. England has had these experiences of being reduced to such things, but refuses to see others in this way, and challenges everyone to look beyond this narrow view. He says that terms liberal and conservative are examples of this mischief that reliance on spectral evidence can do to a community, especially since these terms once identified two equally ethical and value political perspectives. For the next 5 years, England is not published in Dialogue or Sunstone, or participate in the Sunstone Symposia, by request of BYU Presidents Rex Lee and Merrill Bateman. It is during this period that many people are fired or being forced into retirement, especially in the English department at BYU. During Merrill Bateman's administration, England is asked to retire without protest in 1998. The administration does not give England any justification for this action. England is humiliated but does not publicly lash out as he had after not being granted tenure at St. Olaf in the 70s. Even though England has this forced retirement from BYU, England is not ready to give up his passion for teaching college students. So England begins to teach at Utah Valley State College, now called Utah Valley University, in the fall of 1998. He is named as the school's first writer-in-residence and begins to teach Mormon literature classes at the college. England also helps in the development of the Ethics Center on campus, through which a Mormon studies program is created, one of the first in the nation. Along with the Ethics Center at UVSC, England also participates in inter-ecumenical dialogues, one of which is published after his death. England also promotes and participates in more discussions with postmodernists and feminists. England begins to publish in Dialogue and Sunstone again, continuing to promote the role of intellectual dialogue in the Mormon community. By 2000, the programs at UVSC are becoming well-established and are even receiving grants. England now argues for freedom in Utah higher education in multiple newspapers as well as presentations. England's final Sunstone Symposium address, called Calculated Risk, Freedom for Mormons in Utah Higher Education, is a powerful culmination of all that England has been fighting for on college campuses. England's argument in this paper is that in 1960, the University of Utah was the institution in Utah higher education with the greatest academic freedom. BYU was in 1990, and now it is UVSC in 2000, which may be the place where both faculty and students have the greatest opportunity for genuinely free and productive intellectual inquiry. England mentions current articles that discuss the issues of Mormonism at the U and how differences are not meshing there. England believes that people do not see these differences as an educational opportunity. Since the University of Utah has the majority of LDS students, it should take advantage of this by fostering healthy discussion that address Mormon culture and history. England's comments on this experiences at BYU, saying that despite the golden age of the 1980s, many have now become defeated by the culture wars of the 1990s. England gives a history of struggles for academic freedom, especially in the United States, in this address. He acknowledges that academic freedom is a risk, but one that is necessary, and I quote, "Academic freedom is not an inherent natural right, nor a basic constitutional right protected under the First Amendment. It is a calculated risk, a privilege granted by society, which pays the taxes and gives the contributions which make possible our very expensive and higher educational system. A risk taken because society has come to accept that academic freedom serves the long-term best interests of society. Both academic freedom and tenure have been recognized by most thinkers to have serious disadvantages, but most also believe the benefits accrued to society are well worth those disadvantages. It is a calculated risk and always fragile, in danger of being misused or diminished." End quote. This calculated risk of academic freedom has been tested and challenged, but is still seen as important. While quoting Walter Lippmann's essay called The Indispensable Opposition, England actually gets emotional in his address. His voice wavers. This is one of the few times in his recorded presentations that this occurs. At this point, the brain cancer that caused England's death was probably affecting his emotions, but I also think it shows how important this subject is to England. And I quote, "We must protect the right of our opponents to speak, because we must hear what they have to say. Because freedom of discussion improves our own opinions. The liberties of others are our own vital necessity. Freedom of speech may not produce the truth, but if the truth can be found, there is no other system which will normally and habitually find so much truth." End quote. England says that we are all failing as Mormons in rejecting our heritage because of our unwillingness to take the calculated risk of free exploration and expressions which Mormon theology itself claims is necessary for individual salvation, and which existed even at the highest levels in earlier times within the church. England sees a 1969 statement to BYU students by Hubie Brown again as the correct Mormon position on academic freedom. "One of the most important things in the world is freedom of the mind. From this, all other freedoms spring. Such freedom is necessarily dangerous, for one cannot think right without running the risk of wrong. But generally, more thinking is the antidote for evils that spring from wrong thinking. Think through on every proposition that is submitted to you, and be unafraid to express your opinions with proper respect for those to whom you talk and proper acknowledgement of your own shortcomings." And this is England after his comment from that quote. If that is, as I believe it is, an accurate statement of the official Mormon position on academic freedom, then the place Mormons can, in the year 2000, expect to find the greatest academic freedom is not BYU, certainly not the University of Utah. It just may be UBSC. End quote. England shares the hopes that he has for the future of academic freedom and how teachers at UBSC are working with the challenges, what he calls the Scylla and Charybdis that we must pass between, and their works to find the correct balance in their studies of faith and reason to have true dialogue occur. England finishes the paper with a final caution and obligation for students. Quote, "Students need to grow up, assume that college will challenge their thinking, and cause them to reassess their culture values, because that is precisely what higher education is for. It is to move us from being provincial to being citizens of the world. Otherwise, our world and even our Utah society are condemned to continue in prejudice and discrimination, and even violence." This last comment to students, as well as the whole presentation, is the cautioning of one who has experienced much in life. England is bold in his assessment and confident in his hope for the future. Within a year of this lecture, England died from brain cancer. This lecture becomes quite significant because of this, as it is the last large public presentation we have from England. In a 1988 essay, where England looked back on the beginnings of Dialogue the Journal, he explains how the personal essay is the best literary form to express prophetic voice. The voice that England sees existing in the personal essay is the voice that the most influential prophets in the LDS tradition use. England believes that Dialogue the Journal has made it possible for writers to develop this same voice. Even though England never declares himself as a prophetic voice, which would have undermined the power of such a voice, I believe, the fact that England links the prophetic voice with the soft, piercing, and personal voice of the personal essay, his favorite form of expression, means he is prophetic in some way. He purposely develops his own uniquely Mormon prophetic voice in his writings. England is best known for his development of the Mormon personal essay. Recognized as the father of the Mormon personal essay, England is one of the most powerful Mormon writers with a prophetic voice from the latter part of the 20th century, is my claim. England, in all of his writings, and through his life, called for people to act. Even though England had been gone for almost 10 years, his words and examples are still influential. He serves as a prophetic voice within Mormonism. And like any prophetic voice, his words remain relevant. Today, we should continue to fight for what England risked so much to defend, the calculated but valuable risk of dialogue and academic freedom on our own college campuses and within religious institutions here in Utah. At the University of Utah, as we continue into the 21st century, we need to continue to create a campus where such opposition and dialogue can exist so that each side will be able to come out with more truth than they had before. We should not ignore our history or the value of engaging with the dominant culture in Utah. At the same time, all voices and cultures must have an equal opportunity to be analyzed and celebrated. Our cultural assumptions need to be challenged. It is only through this process that we can truly gain the type of education that will help us in such a diverse world that we have today. We are on the right path, and we are seeing the needed improvements to make this type of education possible, but we still have many ways that we can improve. I believe that Mormon intellectuals have an important responsibility in helping those needed improvements to occur. We should never be satisfied with our current position. Only through struggling to express and understand our core beliefs can we come closer to creating the ideal learning environment that England envisioned on university campuses, both religious and secular? Thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte. I think I've had some experiences with Jean over 50 years, I guess, and I think she certainly represented him well. There, I'm glad to have you up there.
Thank you.
Time for comments, questions you might have. I may ask the first one. Jean, in that statement he made in the 90s about the place for academic freedom and to be expressed, certainly was not the University of Utah, I don't know BYU, but UVU. As the University of Utah, if you've been up there, have they shed that image, you think?
Yes, to an extent. I've noticed, I think it's on. I've noticed that in my experiences at the University of Utah, especially recently, that there's been a lot of improvements. For instance, I work at the LDS Institute at the university. I'm president of the student association there. And I've noticed a lot more respect for the LDS community within campus and working with a lot of different groups on campus, which didn't happen as much before, especially in the 90s. And so I'm seeing a lot of that improvement. And I think with this religious studies program starting at the U, it makes a big difference. And I think, again, the idea is that we need to be able to continue to improve on that, that it needs to be something that continues forward. So it's going in the right direction, I think, and getting to a place where I think we can have that open dialogue and a safe space for Mormons to be able to feel comfortable at the university. So I think it's changing, but definitely needs more improvements, too.
And do you see your grandfather in heaven clapping?
Maybe.
All right. Okay, any other questions? Let's Mike. Here's the mic.
Go to the mic. You mentioned that Jean was forced into retirement from BYU. Mm-hmm. In what way specifically was that handled, and what was the effect that it had on him from that point on?
Okay. How it was handled is, again, like I mentioned, England had been asked to stop publishing in Dialogue and Sunstone for about 5 years by different university presidents of BYU. In about 97, he was called into Merrill Bateman's office and asked to retire. Essentially, it was a very simple kind of thing, we're asking you to leave. They didn't give him any explanation. And the tricky thing was, is he was a tenured professor, so it was an interesting situation for him to find himself in. And after that, it did have a significant effect on him. I think it was hard for him, but I think it's important to realize that he did start teaching at UVSC immediately after that, and that he continued forward. But I think that had a huge influence on that 2000 address that he gave at Sunstone. And it also had a particular effect on our family as well. But it's been interesting to see what the effect has been. So I think he handled it a lot better than some of the rest of us did. But it was a hard thing to go through. But considering how he did it, it was a lot of charity and not complaining or making a public stand against it in any way. He just continued on. I think that's an important thing that shows how he felt like that wasn't something important for him to dwell on, that he just needed to continue to do the things he saw as important. So.
I hope there's a history someday written of that before too much is lost, because I'd like to learn more. But your talk made me think a lot about various issues, like prophetic voice. Mm-hmm. To me, suggests that God is inspiring that person. Mm-hmm. And dialogue is two people talking to each other.
Yes.
Hopefully, with some measure of intelligence or revelation or mm-hmm. something coming that's true. And but those sound different to me.
Yeah.
Dialogue, prophetic voice. Mm-hmm. And then institutionalized prophetic mantle and voice. Mm-hmm. Those all seem kind of different to me. And you said, seemed like more than once, that this dialogue is our best shot at getting at the truth. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't disagree. But then I'm also wondering where these other forms and so forth fit in this idea, bigger idea, of getting at the truth. How does it all come together, and where does dialogue fit in relation to these other modes of revelation?
Okay. So my argument in my paper, again, is the idea that England is a prophetic voice. And again, that's different. A lot of people, that's a very charged word within the LDS community, as we very well know. The idea versus like an authoritative prophet, like Thomas S. Monson, versus a prophetic voice. And so, again, I agree with you. The idea of a prophetic voice, I think all of us, which we learn in LDS doctrine, can be inspired by God and can receive by the Spirit direction in what we say and in what we think and the intellect that we have. And so I think that's where I'm coming down with that prophetic voice idea. And in many ways, we do see the institutionalized prophetic voice. You see lots of different types. Like, you see people that are outside of an institution and within an institution that can be prophetic voice. It's always a struggle, though, if you're an institutionalized prophetic voice, because it's the idea that you still believe in an authority figure over you that has that prophet mantle that you would obey and listen to. And so that's what I'm claiming England is that one that still believes in the authoritative prophet and will follow that prophet no matter what they ask. Again, making sure that they're questioning themselves and have the Spirit confirm it to them. But I think how it works is within those dialogues that we have with each other and discussions that we have with people that differ from us, I believe that we can be inspired from God when we are in those discussions with other people. That we can, in that process of opening up and questioning, which we learn a lot, especially in the Doctrine and Covenants, the idea of studying it out in your mind. I think part of that is having discussions with other people. And by going through that process, God is able to inspire us on the direction that we're supposed to go. And so I think within that, that's how, again, that prophetic voice, which each of us can technically have, because the idea that we can receive direction, and as we're followers of Christ, we can receive the direction from our Heavenly Father to be able to know what we're supposed to do. And again, through that discussion with others, we can come closer to that and know what he wants us to continue to do on in our life. So, I hopefully that answered it, but I don't know for sure if it did.
We'll start at that. What?
Start of the mind.
What? Let me ask you some questions before we get into the... talked about that we can express ourselves, we should think it out. We listen to what the authority figure says, and you said your father would, if the authority figure said this ultimately is the way to go, he would fall in line and do it.
Yeah.
But what if he doesn't get a confirmation by the Spirit about that that's the way to go? How would he deal with that?
I don't know.
Okay. That's a fair answer.
I'm not him, so I don't know.
Well, did he say anything? Did he written anything which would indicate that?
I think in a lot of ways, for instance, I think a perfect example might be when Blacks were denied the priesthood. He had seen that not within... He actually went to an apostle about it because he had never seen it in LDS scripture where it said any reason why Blacks could not have the priesthood, like a mark of Cain or something, the justifications that he found within the church when he went to Sunday school, which were a struggle for him. And he went and talked to an apostle, I can't remember which apostle it was. Joseph Fielding Smith. about it. Sat down in his office, and Joseph Fielding Smith pulled out his scriptures and started going to the scriptures that said, well, these are what we use. And he looked at him and was like, actually, I don't see how we've been able to justify it with these scriptures. And honestly, I can't tell you why we do not give Blacks a priesthood. The only thing I can tell you is that we have that as a position for the church, and so you should follow that. But if anybody tells you that those are the reasons, you can't justify it that way. And I, as apostle, say that I don't see it in there. And so hopefully that will be something that changes. But for right now, we follow what is the direction of the church. So that's the only instance in his life where he talks about something similar to that, where it was the idea of following what the church leaders were doing, even if he had that hope that it would change. And he did. When it happened in 1978, as I've heard from my family, it was a very special moment for our family. And celebrating that and knowing that it wasn't based on things that people thought, it was more of the culture and being prepared for something like that. So.
Thanks. Okay.
I am maybe missing something because I have to confess that I'm not Mormon, but I am an academic and I have recently, long taught a course that Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and Pentecostals. And I've recently been writing comparative stuff.
Yeah.
I do not understand why a man who you portray as standing so strongly for academic freedom would go so quietly when he's a tenured professor without recently even. In a way, this seems to me to be undermining what tenure is about.
Mm-hmm.
That he should have asked for, demanded an explanation. Otherwise, he's giving in on tenure, which is important to the sort of academic freedom we're talking about.
Yes.
Now, I don't know what I'm missing, but I need to understand this better.
Yeah, that's something that I've been trying to figure out as well. I don't know if it's part of because of how much he had gone through in those years before that happened, but I think he was just very tired with the whole situation. I think I probably would have reacted slightly differently if something like that had happened to me, because it's interesting, when other people were being dismissed from BYU during that time, he would stand up for them and say, this wasn't fair, you shouldn't be doing something like this. But then when it did happen to himself, he didn't really do anything. And so that's something I need to, that's part of, in the 1990s, I still need to study that more. I'm planning on extending my research, and hopefully by doing that, I can maybe find some answers to why he did that so quietly, because it's a very interesting thing. So I'm not sure, and it's something I do want to look into more, so.
I don't know, I thought from knowing him at the time, so as my name is Miles Kimball, I just thought that he believed in obedience. And so he would stand up for academic freedom and say lots of things unless he was specifically ordered not to. Or so when he was ordered by someone who was an authoritative official of the church, so the problem was the president of BYU was also a church authority, and so he obeyed. So whenever he wasn't specifically ordered to do something, he would stand up for academic freedom and all kinds of things. But when he was specifically ordered to do something, he obeyed. And I think very few people take that stance. It was a very unusual thing about Gene Eaglet, extremely unusual.
Thank you.
Mark?
I conducted a couple of interviews with my father and my mother before he died, and I specifically probed what happened in that meeting with the academic vice president, where my mom and my dad were there, and they basically said, you're fired. My dad didn't question it. My mom did. She directly said, why are you doing this? And said, you are behaving in an unchristian way. And she was the one that really put him on the spot. Now, as for whether my father was being obedient or what the situation is, we can only guess to a certain extent, and you know, eventually those tapes will be on the website and available for viewing and your own analysis. Personally, I believe he reached a point where there was no academic freedom that he could defend and fight for at BYU on the level that he needed. And I think that's ultimately why he just decided, this is not a fight worth fighting anymore. The cost is too high, and that he would go somewhere where the fight would be at least relatively productive. But that's just my own guess.
Another piece of evidence that he believed in obedience was the... another piece of evidence of the way he believed in obedience was how he reacted to the disagreement with Bruce R. McConkie.
Yes.
And I thought it was fairly clear from that context that he said, you know, obviously I don't agree with Bruce R. McConkie intellectually, but since he's somebody in authority over me, I'll do what he says.
Yeah. Which, by the way, my Aunt Rebecca is going to be talking about later today, so you should go to the panel later.
Handful.
This may be a small point, I don't know. We tend to have a certain concept, and you're talking about a prophetic voice and whether how that fits within Mormonism, within the Mormon context, where we have this notion of one prophet who's spanning the whole time and is the leader of everything. And it's at least worth noticing that in our scriptures, there are a lot of different concepts of prophets and prophetic voices and times that they come up, and I'm probably not supposed to do a scriptural discussion here, but if you read the book of Chronicles, little prophets are shoving up all the time to say one thing, when nobody else is ready to say there, thus saith the Lord, you know, this battle is not yours, but the Lord's, go out there the next day and you'll find that you don't need to fight. That sort of stuff all the time is happening from one really insightful and tuned individual. And we ought to encourage that among ourselves rather than simply always deferring to imagining the one guy is going to tell us the whole story.
Francis?
I remember I was at a meeting with Jean England in England at the Hyde Park Ward in a Sunday school class, and the teacher, he was not teaching, he was just attending, and they started talking about obedience, and he made the comment, obedience is not a virtue. And he did it within the context of talking about obedience. You know, he went through the German kind of thing, the idea that you obey no matter what. And when you look at all the other virtues, which are, you know, charity and those kind of things, those standalone virtues, obedience is not one of those. It is deeply, deeply contextual, whether you obey or not. So you don't put it up with other virtues. And I remember that little mini speech he gave very well.
Get a moral interview on that one.
Okay, sounds good.
That certainly is in conflict with the currency of words in the church today. Obedience is pretty high on the scale.
Do you think that Eugene's dismissal from BYU was an acknowledgement by Elder Bacon and the brethren of his prophetic voice?
I think that from personal things that I've heard from different apostles within the church, I know that there's different opinions within that. So I think it wasn't something, a uniform idea that the brethren were dismissing what England was standing for. I think part of them, yes. I think there's been always kind of a split. There's some that are Eugene England was very good friends with and spoke with a lot, including Hugh B. Brown, Elder Holland, some others. And so I think what that shows is that idea that with what was going on with the culture wars in the 1990s at BYU, I think it shows this idea that they were overreacting in some way, trying to protect this institution that they had created. With that, it was those ideas, the ones that thought with what England was saying was not appropriate, that they, I guess you could say, won out over the other ones in that kind of a situation. Is a way to see it. So I don't think it was a uniform idea of, like, this shows a complete dismissal of everyone. Because I've spoken to Elder Hayden, Elder Holland, and some others, and they still to this day are like, your grandfather was somebody that I really respected and loved that he was at BYU and advocated for him. So I know that it's not all of them personally, at least. So, but
do we have any Hubie Browns in the church leadership?
Well, I think we've got some that are close, but I don't know if anybody can really beat Hugh B. Brown again because he's pretty great. So
they're not in the position Hugh B. Brown was.
No, yeah, they're not.
You know, if you read the four Gospels, which I think is where we should understand Jesus primarily, the Book of Mormon, other things would be secondary. Read the four Gospels, and especially the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus is frequently challenging or criticizing the highest authority that he should be obeying, that is the law, the Torah. And especially in the Gospel of Matthew, he frequently is either criticizing the law or disobeying it, ignoring it, and disobeying it. And my question would be, isn't the prophetic voice almost inevitably be a disobedient voice?
I think on some level, yes. And I think it depends on also the extent of that prophetic voice. For example, I think it comes around with the authority concept too, because of course we claim the idea that Christ, being the Son of God, has that authority to speak out in that specific way and undermine the old law. You can see people that do it today, but not to that extent, which I would say England would, because it comes to a point where it's like, well, I will obey what the prophet says or the brethren say. Come to that obedience, but challenge things in a way that I think is more appropriate, considering that I'm not who this person is. And so I think it's that difference of what that prophetic voice is, which is why that interpretation is kind of larger than what you can call prophetic voice. So.
Not only Jesus, but Jeremiah and Isaiah.
Hi. Great job. Really enjoyed your presentation. Big fan of your grandfather. I'm a little confused about the definition of academic freedom, however. It seems to me that it's a bit of a tautology in that there's the presumption that academic freedom, as you've presented it, leads to truth. What if it doesn't lead to truth? And it also seems that at a university, that kind of academic freedom is academic freedom on Mormonism's own terms and not in kind of a broader sense. So this notion of being friendly to Mormons in Utah versus at a university outside of Utah, I think it's kind of a different question, I think. So I just wanted to hear your response on the definition of academic freedom in that way.
Okay. So I'm kind of going off of how England defined academic freedom in his 2000 symposium lecture. Because with him, it's the idea that, and he quotes some other people on saying the idea that, yes, sometimes that academic freedom does not lead to truth, but overall, majority-wise, in the long run, it will, is what he kind of quotes on some people. So yes, there is a risk with academic freedom that it can lead to something within that can be not the truth. But I think what his claim was is the idea that the more that you have that type of discussion occurring, the better it is. And I agree with you. Inside of Utah, outside of Utah, it's a big difference on how that academic freedom looks. And the reason that I'm trying to claim it, at least for the University of Utah, since I've been there, and my personal opinion with it, because I don't think it should be the idea that, because Mormon culture is a big effect in Utah, obviously, and has a big influence on those universities already, even if we don't acknowledge it in a lot of ways. Mormons are all over the University of Utah campus in administrative roles, in classes, teaching or not. So I think it's the idea that we have to be careful, and I think the reason that England was talking about it is the idea that you couldn't, especially at BYU and some other places, you had to let those other people, that what people would say the outsiders, have an opportunity to be there besides just the Mormon culture that's dominant. And so for me, the idea of academic freedom would be to really have those different opinions expressed, different groups having the opportunity to discuss and be in discussion with each other and not letting that Mormon culture overwhelm those other opportunities. And I think the U's done a really good job of having other groups being able to have a voice, and which I think is appropriate. I think it needs to continue to improve, though. I think that people need to be able to feel comfortable, whoever they are, in that setting. So it's just trying to work out the detail of how that works within a Mormon culture on a campus as well. So.
Can you clarify for me, during the years when he was not allowed to publish in dialogue and mm-hmm. in Sunstone, was he silenced altogether on the issues that mattered to him? What was he doing?
What was he doing?
Yes.
Okay.
And another separate comment related to what you've just been saying. I'm not sure that this is an issue that just applies to Utah. I think it is an issue which applies to any college, university that is run by an authoritarian religious group.
Yes.
To what extent can you have academic freedom when the authorities see themselves as being such God-given authority?
Yes, I agree. Yes. What England was doing mainly in those 5 years, he was writing a few books, so he was doing some collections of essays, including Making Peace, which had some personal essays in it, so it was a collection of that. He was also helping to publish different, he was editing different books, for instance, books of poetry and other Mormon writings as well. So mainly what he did is instead of presenting in dialogue, writing in dialogue or Sunstone, is he collected writings of other people and started publishing his own writings in a way that, official book form is mainly what he was doing during that time. So he actually got a lot of books out, actually, in those 5 years. Am I correct? Okay, good.
Let me close. It's time for, but with just one observation about why he may have gone silently when he was, you know, fired. His mentor at the University of Utah was first and foremost Lowell Bainman, who essentially went through the same process. Was just summarily, he was not fired. He was told, "We want to move you down to BYU and let you be down there where you can grow and flower among the process down there." And Brother Bainman felt differently about it. And I think that both Brother Bainman and Gene were terribly loyal to the institution. They're Mormons, you know, in their DNA. I mean, I feel a lot of that myself too. They felt that was not kicking against the pricks in that fashion is not what one should do in Mormon culture, and quietly go away and that's what he did. And not so quietly. He went over to the UV and but he accepted what was a very arbitrary decision. Great. Well, thank you very much, Sean. I think you did a wonderful job.